Hello and welcome back to the God Story Podcast. I'm Brent Siddle and I'm joined once again by Dr. Alistair Roberts of the Theopolis Institute in the States for another look at the Book of Revelation. And the journey is just about coming to an end. Alistair, this time we're looking at chapter 20.
Very near to the end, only three chapters.
Yeah, it's a bit like coming to the end of The Lord of the Rings, really, isn't it? Or even better, possibly. Now, what's the structure of Revelation 20 and what actually happens in Revelation 20?
So Revelation 20 is perhaps one of the most controverted texts in the book of Revelation because it's where we meet the millennium. The millennium, the thousand years, which comes in this chapter, is also accompanied by a last hurrah, as it were, for Satan and his forces, and then the final judgment scene. And so this is really wrapping things up after the events of the destruction of Babylon and the great victory of that leads to the wedding feast in the preceding chapters.
Yes. Now, how does, before we come on to the millennium, a fun topic, isn't it? How does chapter 20 describe the binding of Satan?
The binding of Satan is perhaps best seen as the second phase of the descent of Satan. Satan has already been cast out of heaven in chapter 12, and now he's bound. He's limited in what he can do. And in particular, he's not able to go out and deceive the nations as he once did. And so that's a change in his power and authority. And we can see gradually, in two key blows, Satan is restricted. First of all, by being removed from the center of power in heaven itself. And then second, in being bound or restricted in his activities on earth. And then there is an even later descent as he's cast into the lake of fire.
Yes. Now, how are we to understand the millennium here? How do you understand the millennium?
So typically, when people talk about the millennium, they give three positions that can be held on the subject. So there's post-millennialism, premillennialism, and amillennialism. And these can be subdivided. So you have dispensational premillennialism and the various versions of that. So you'll have post-trib and pre-trib and mid-trib, depending upon when the people are raptured. And then you have post-millennial position, which can often be divided in different ways. You can think about some divisions that would have amillennialism as a subdivision of post-millennialism. Then you have historic post-millennialism, the sort of post-millennialism that you find within the Puritans, and then various iterations of preterist post-millennial positions. So partial preterist post-millennialism, which would be the position that I hold to, and then full preterist, and then other forms of it. And we could think also of amillennialism as a position with quite a lot of pedigree. Think about Augustine's position as a form of amillennialism. But it's worth reflecting upon the fact that each of these is in some way or other addressing slightly different questions. And there are ways in which you could hold technically to all of these positions, at least nominally. So amillennialism is asking whether the millennium is a literal period of time. I don't believe that the millennium is a literal period of 1,000 years. Rather, the millennium is a symbolic, lengthy period of time. So it is an actual period of time, but the 1,000 years is a symbolic way of referring to an actual period of time. Then you have the positions that would take it as a literal period of time, 1,000 years, as there are some historic post-millennial and historic premillennial and dispensational premillennial positions that would think in terms of a literal 1,000 years. And then you have post-millennialism, which is asking when relative to the millennium does Christ return, or when relative to the millennium is the awaited final coming of Christ. You might think about premillennialism as answering the question. It could be the same question as postmillennialism, or it could be the question of when, relative to the millennium, is the expected return of Christ spoken of for the most part in Revelation? When is that return? Now, when you think about it that way, if you hold the position that I hold, which is that the millennium is a symbolic rather than a literal period of time, but it is an actual period of time, it's a period of time in which we are currently situated, and it's a period of time that follows the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70, and which will be followed by the return of Christ, we can see that each one of those positions is in some way nominally at least represented. Amillennialism, in that this is a symbolic period of time, not a literal one, and it's a period of time in which we're currently situated. And then postmillennialism, in that the expected final coming of Christ happens after the millennium. And then premillennialism, in that the events spoken of for the most part in the book of Revelation precede the expected return of Christ, generally precedes the events of the millennium, because it refers to AD 70. So the question then becomes, what exactly is involved in the millennium? First of all, we have the description of Satan being bound. He's restricted in his activity. There's a rising up of the righteous martyrs. Think about the 144,000, those who are beheaded for Christ. This is the core group defined by the 12 tribes, the 120 from each tribe. This is a symbolic body of Israel, but the full complement from each tribe. And I would see this as representing in some ways the center of a new polity. It's the first resurrection. It's not the final resurrection, but it's an initial step towards that. Now we can think about the way that the resurrection is an event that's spread out through time. So Christ is the first fruits, but there is a larger complex of events that belong to that. The people of Christ are going to be raised in him. Their resurrection is an extension of, and as a result of, his resurrection. Now, the first resurrection, I think, is the emptying out of the righteous from Hades, from the realm of the dead, and the raising up of those righteous to rule with Christ. That's the first resurrection. And then the second resurrection is the final, is the resurrection proper, the raising of the body, the restoration of all things, the new heavens and the new earth in their fullest sense. And so this period of time is a period in which the righteous have dominance. It's a period of time in which Satan's kingdom is crippled. It's a period of time in which the gospel is expanding throughout the world, and there is a sort of prosperity for the gospel. Now, there are historic ways of spinning this differently. So some would see this period of time as a period of time that's going to be leading to a golden age that hasn't yet started yet. You can think about the Puritans, who expected the conversion of the Jews, almost all of the Jews, this expectation that this millennium period would be this glorious period for the gospel. It spread the exaltation of the people of God and the blessing of creation at this period of time. Now, it's not the final coming of Christ. It's before that. Likewise, a more modern form of postmillennialism often expects that although we are currently in the millennium, there is this more glorious form that will be its mature expression. So we're currently maybe even in the earlier phases of the millennium. And this is going to be a gradual outworking of the kingdom of Christ, like the leaven in the loaves, or like the growth of the mustard seed that grows to fill the whole earth. It will be a period of time over which, during which Christ will subdue all of his enemies under his feet. So it will be a progressive development towards the dominance of Christ's kingdom on earth. Now, that allows for reversals. It allows for ups and downs. It allows for ebbing and flowing in certain places. It allows for uneven progress. In some places, the gospel might be advancing. In others, it might be falling back, apparently. So those are some of the positions that people will hold. I hold a form of post-millennialism in which there is maybe less of an expectation of an extreme golden age, but I believe that the gospel will be advancing until the end of this age, at which time there will be a final rebellion and Satan will be defeated completely at that point, definitively, or finally.
Yes, well, we could go, that's a very full and complex answer, and we could go in a number of directions. I just wanted, before we carry on with the discussion, I want to ask you about the significance of the number 1,000 and how that's symbolic.
So when we think about a number like 1,000, we need to think about how it breaks down. If we get a number like 84, we break it down into 12 times 7. Number like 1,000 is very straightforward because it's a cube. It's a number that has a different shape from a square, but it's related to a square, and a different shape from a triangle. And we can maybe think about these numbers in terms of their shape. So a square number has certain connotations, etc. And within scripture, there are a number of triangular numbers, and there are a number of triangular numbers in Revelation. We can think about the division of Israel into 144,000, which is 12 times 12 times 1,000. And 1,000 is 10 times 10 times 10. That triangular number, or that cube, is one that we find several occasions. It's a large number. And so 1,000 or 1,000 times 10,000, these sorts of numbers represent a large quantity, and it's a symbolic number that represents the full complement of that. Or we can think about the ways in which the measurements of certain sacred areas have 1,000 in on occasions, the temple of Ezekiel, or the areas around in the Holy Land in the book of Ezekiel, the great temple, or not the temple, the holy city that we find in a few chapters' time. All of these are examples of the occurrence of the number 1,000 as a multiple of other numbers, or as a number that stands by itself.
Okay, then. In what sense, then, are these saints and martyrs reigning now?
Yes. So when we talk about the death of those who died in the Old Testament, it can often be presented in a far more negative sense. Those who have died have gone to the realm of the dead. They've gone to be with their fathers. There's a sense of moving away from the realm of life, authority, action, worship. All these sorts of things are things that are no longer enjoyed by the dead in the same way. And yet in the New Testament, there's a positive sense to death. Blessed are those who die in the Lord. Their works will follow them. Or we can think about the way that Paul speaks about, it's better for me to go and be with Christ. There's a sense of the positive sense of death that there was not in the past. And I think that's because the situation of the dead has changed. They now ascend to be with Christ. They have no longer been placed into this antechamber waiting for the final judgment, but they are now brought into the heavenly throne room. And there has been a more general shift from the throne room that we saw in chapters 4 and 5, where you have the living creatures around the throne, and then you have the 24 elders. Now, increasingly, you have a human populated throne room. You have the Lamb in the center, and then you have around the throne the 144,000, and then the great multitude. These are participants at this point. And the 24 elders that we had earlier on, they cast their crowns before the throne. And it seems to me that their thrones and their crowns are taken up by other parties. And the thrones that are established at this point are the thrones of the righteous martyrs. This is the new polity, as it were, of heaven. And so the vision here, I think, is of a new heavenly order in which the righteous now rule. And that rule is one in which the kingdom of God is expanding. It's a period of time in which Satan is thwarted and foiled and limited and bound. And it's a period of time that is one of the growth of Christ's kingdom and the crushing of Satan under his feet and under his people's feet. As we see in Romans chapter 16, the crushing of Satan is not just under the feet of Christ, it's under the feet of his body, the church, as well. And so I think that is what's referred to in part here.
Yeah.
The general prosperity of the church as it spreads out. Now, that can be understood in different ways. Some have seen this principally in terms of a sort of gospel prosperity, that the message of the gospel is successful as it goes out into the world. Others have given more of a political twist, that the people of God are prosperous over their enemies, and their enemies are destroyed. There's a sense of victory and dominion, that's where the accent is. And I think there's something of that, but there can be a bit of a danger in overplaying that line.
Mm. Now, who or what is Gog and Magog, and what is the battle mentioned?
Go back to Ezekiel and the very end of Ezekiel, and we see in many ways the same beats as that in the chapters that follow. So first of all, there is a resurrection in chapter 37. The spirit raises the bones of the whitened bones, as the prophet speaks to the bones and speaks to the spirit, and the spirit comes upon them and brings them to life, and they, with a rattling, they become a great army. And then in chapters 38 and 39, there's an attack from Gog and Magog. And in the chapters that follow, 40 to 48, there is the building, the new temple, and the glorious new order of the land that is related to that, the different gates of the city, the water flowing out. And all of this is a vision that provides a very important background and backdrop for the final chapters of Revelation. So you have the raising up of this mighty company in the first resurrection. You have the battle of Gog and Magog, connected to chapters 38 and 39. And then you have the heavenly city, and that corresponds to the temple of Ezekiel. And the water flowing out, of course, in chapter 47, corresponds to the river of life that flows from the city in these chapters.
Mm.
The battle of Gog and Magog, different arguments have been put forward for what it means in the context of Ezekiel. James Jordan, for instance, argues that it's the threat posed by the rebellion, or the rebellion and the action of Haman, who seeks to really outwit the king and place himself into a position of greater authority, and then also his attack upon the Jews. And that is one that is thwarted, and he's an Agagite. And so the suggestion is that there is a play, a relation between Gog and Magog and Agag, those words being connected. This is a reference to Haman and his plot. That provides a sort of archetypal background for the events of this chapter. The exact agency is not necessarily the point. We have a number of occasions within Revelation to this point where we've read of Sodom, or we've read of Babylon, or we've read of some other city that is, or some other agency that is symbolic of this, the agencies within the text, whether that's Jerusalem or whether it's Rome. Here, it's not entirely clear what it is, but archetypally, this is the pattern of Ezekiel 37 to 48.
Now, why do the dead arise from three locations here, the sea, death, and Hades?
So we've got the world model that we've thought about on various occasions, where the sea is connected to the Gentiles, the land is connected to Israel, and then death and Hades, that's the area below the earth, some ways connected to the sea. But I think it's referring to the realm of the dead, those who have passed in the old covenant order. So this is a judgment of those who have already died, not just those who are in, who are currently living.
What's the second death, the lake of fire?
So if we think about the first and second resurrection, There is an initial deliverance, the raising up of the righteous to reign with Christ, followed by a greater raising up. There's also an initial casting down and binding, and now there will be a greater casting down and a greater, more definitive and final, or more final and conclusive binding. And so there is a movement in both directions. There's a second resurrection, and then there's a second death.
Yes. Now, what are the books mentioned in verse 12? We better deal with those.
Books have been mentioned on various occasions. Of course, the book that had seals that needed to be opened is an important, as it were, plot point in chapters 4 and 5, especially. And the book that's referenced in chapter 13, the Lamb's Book of Life, you can think about the way that the book is mentioned in the letters to the churches, the not removing the name from the book. And then you have references to things like the name that is given to the person who's faithful, who overcomes. So all of these things are themes that have already been introduced within the book. So I was thinking of, I will never blot, the one who conquers will be clothed thus in white garments, and I will never blot his name out of the book of life. I will confess his name before my Father and before his angels. Now, when we do read about the book of life earlier on in chapter, in chapter 13, verse 8, and all who dwell on the earth will worship it, everyone whose name has not been written before the foundation of the world in the book of life, the Lamb who was slain. My reading of that is that that's a reference to the book of life from the foundation of the earth. The point is not that there has been, it's not primarily a sort of predestinarian point that there was a book of life with all the names of all the righteous who would be saved, but more a point that this is a roll call almost of every generation of the righteous that has existed from the foundation of the world. And it's this book that has been kept throughout that whole period of time. And it wasn't all written before that point, but this book has been written from that point. And now that book is being opened up, and those names that are found within it are going to be blessed, and those names that are not found within it, or those names that have been removed from it, are going to be cast into outer darkness.
Mm. Last question, Alistair. I think we're fast running out of time. There's so much in this chapter, isn't there? It's fabulous. We talked about the millennium and said that that's the current age, in effect. In what sense, then, does the church have the power of the keys during the gospel age to restrict and restrain Satan?
Yes, that's a very important connection to draw, that the church has been given the power of the keys to bind and to loose. This is maybe something that can be helped in, we may be helped in our understanding of this by thinking back to things like the commission of the prophet Jeremiah and other statements that we find in places like that, where, for instance, the prophet is told, "Behold, I have put my words in your mouth. See, I have set you this day over nations and over kingdoms to pluck up and to break down, to destroy and to overthrow, to build and to plant." And he's threatened and attacked, and he's a sort of martyr figure, but he's told, "Do not be dismayed by them, lest I dismay you before them. And I, behold, I make you this day a fortified city, an iron pillar and bronze walls against the whole land, against the kings of Judah, its officials, its priests, and the people of the land. They will fight against you, but they shall not prevail against you, for I am with you, declares the Lord, to deliver you." Now, of course, when we get to Matthew chapter 16, the language that's used there, "Upon this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell will not prevail against it," that sort of language, and the keys of the kingdom, all of these sorts of things. "Whatever you bind on earth shall be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven." All of this is the same sort of thing that's being referred to. It's the power, prophetic power, of those who have been established as having that gospel authority. And so just as the word is placed upon the prophet's mouth, And so his words are the words of God that are spoken forth. So the church has been given the word of Christ. And as it speaks forth the word of Christ, as it prays confidently in the Spirit, it has authority to bind and to loose, to limit the authority, the activity of Satan, and also to spread the gospel. And that confidence is one that should drive the church's mission. It's something that is a power that was not enjoyed in former times. When we compare the era of the gospel with the era that, for instance, we encounter in the wilderness and the period of time in, let's say, under the judges or something like that, or even in the age of the kingdom, we have a very different power, a very different extent of the Spirit and the gospel's influence and activity in the creation. And that is, I think, part of what the millennium refers to. The hope of Moses that would that all the people of the Lord would prophesy, that the Spirit would come upon them, or the words of Joel that the Spirit of God would come upon the people in the latter days. We are in those latter days. The Spirit has come upon the church. The Spirit has placed powerful words within our mouth. The tongues of fire that come upon the church on the day of Pentecost are fiery tongues by which the word of God is spoken forth. And so that power to bind and to loose, that power to enact and to go forth in the reality of the binding of Satan, and to spread that, I think, is one that needs to drive our understanding. And it's also something that has, I think, a very strong historical basis as we read the descriptions of the early church fathers and others, that wherever the gospel was spreading, the old shrines, the old oracles were shutting down. They were failing. They were no longer responding to the petitioners and the worshippers that were going to find insight there. The word of Christ was prevailing everywhere. And if you're reading the book of Revelation, bear in mind that this is a book written in a context of great persecution, a context where it seems that the church is very much on the back foot. The church is in a situation where people are maybe leaving and they're struggling to keep going. People are losing their first love. And here's this text talking about the prevailing of the kingdom of Christ. And it's very easy for us in our context to think about that as, oh, this isn't we're looking forward to some future golden age. We are living in many ways in something that was utterly inconceivable to the people in John's time, were it not for the power of the Spirit and the authority of the word of Christ. And that authority is, I think, what really drives the millennium. And it's also that which Jesus speaks about in terms of binding and loosing.
Dr. Alistair Roberts of the Theopolis Institute in the States, thank you very much. A lot in that chapter, Alistair. I think we managed to more or less cover it. Thank you so much. And thanks to our creative team at Liquid Edge, who sponsor this podcast and who take care of things behind the scenes. Alistair, thank you.
Thank you.
We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the God Story Podcast. To ensure you never miss an episode, please subscribe. And if you're enjoying the podcast, please take a moment to give us a rating and leave a review. This will help more people discover God's story for themselves. If you'd like to get in touch or learn more, please visit godstorypodcast.com. We'd love to hear from you. That's godstorypodcast.com.